Hello, good morning and welcome. This lecture is about how to use dialogue as a major way of understanding learning and how to use it as a learning tool. Now, dialogue as a learning tool has been there for a long time, starting from Plato in the ancient Greece, and now it has been used as a mechanism for understanding a broad range of skills in the human. This approach has developed a very sophisticated understanding of human dialogue, a very complex understanding of human dialogue as a contextual tool depending on the context, a temporal tool depending on the time, and a relational tool depending on what kind of relationship there is with respect to the teaching learning situation. Now, despite many significant theoretical progresses, methods for using dialogue had not progressed much beyond what was originally intended by Plato. Some have argued that the dialogical method runs counter, that means is against the core assumptions that meaning is created by context and is an unfinished agenda. In this lecture, I will draw a method for the analysis of dialogue that is built on and compatible with the theoretical assumptions of dialogism. The method that we propose is a distinctive difference between the earlier approaches and how we are going to approach it. It is not merely seen as a procedure, rather it is seen as an operationalization of a theoretical perspective through the posing of sensitizing questions, which facilitates the process of interpretation, but does not finalize the interpretation and understanding of any concept. The notion of dialogism draws upon a broad range of modern scholars, most notably Mikhail Bakhtin, Bakhtin, but also Wittgenstein, the German philosopher, Wittgenstein. Now, for those who understand these distinctive assumptions, say for example Linnell, the emphasis is on the constitutive power of social interaction. It also acknowledges the importance of situation-transcending phenomenon such as discourses, institutions, relationships, and identities. It also puts emphasis on the historicity of human action and acknowledges the human agency. This is a very important part of dialogism when you use dialogue as part of the modern context of how to go about things. Now, why to use dialogues? The approach conceptualizes meaning as arising out of an utterance that is part of a situated dialogue. That is to say, meaning is not found within an utterance in either its logical structure or the dictionary definition of the component words. It is rather found in the relation between the utterance and the broader context, including the participant's own position. Meaning is therefore always for someone. Anybody can create meaning. It could be for a participant within the situation or an outsider, such as somebody who is doing research on it or somebody who is interpreting the situation as an observer. An utterance is defined as any communicative act which is a spoken or written word or even gestural language using of hand movements and sign language. It is both a response and an initiation. Utterances are deeply dialogical because they are responsive and they can also be contested. They can be countered, but also because they are both quote-unquote embodied and quote-unquote socially situated. These being both unique and comprised of the generic gestures. There are three aspects of a dialogical contextualization and how to conceptualize meaning, which we want to draw attention to this in the very beginning. First, meaning is situated in context, in the sense that utterances need a social context to become meaningful. Now, this is in contrast to Ferdinand de Saussure, who had emphasized that the role of language structure, or langue, L-A-N-G-U-E, as a source of the meaning. Dialogism emphasizes the lived reality of language in context or usage, that is parole, P-A-R-O-L-E. It is only in the context of people having aims, a partially shared history and culture, and certain interests in the world that utterances become meaningful. It seems to suggest that these utterances become meaningful only when it is put under context in a particular situation. Secondly, meaning is temporal in nature, in the sense that each utterance is fashioned out of the pre-existing elements, as Bakhtin put it, as both a response to something and something that can be responded to in the future, as Mead has pointed out. Now, people struggle to bend the significance of these second-hand words against their will, as pointed out by Bakhtin. Thus, meaning comes in dialogism not only from what interlocutors are doing, what people are doing, people who are talking to each other, people who are creating those meanings, they are called interlocutors, but also from what has previously been done with respect to the given words and what will be done with them in the future. Thirdly, again following Bakhtin, meaning is addressive in the sense that it always implies an audience. So if you want a dialogic situation, if you want to create meaning, you must have somebody to address it. Speakers are differentiated by various different things like power, relationships, institutional roles, access to material and resources, which may be symbolic resources, level of knowledge, personal history, and many psychological factors. Dialogue succeeds only because the people who participate in it, that is the interlocutors, are able to address these differences and extract meaning from it. Speakers try to speak from the standpoint of their audience. Audience tries to listen from the standpoint of the speaker, and also speakers also try to speak their own viewpoints, and audience also tries to understand from their own viewpoint. Thus, there is always for someone, by someone. Grossen has argued that the aim of developing the methodology of dialogue contradicts the very assumptions of dialogism, and thus not only undesirable but also an impossible task. To look at it in a little more detail, the dialogic theories that are there, they claim that utterances are necessarily multi-voiced and there are multiple meanings. So an analysis closed down the multiplicity and giving ultimate authority to the analyst's voice, the expert's voice. So that becomes the established method. Now from a methodological perspective, however, this requires accountability and rigor of the expert himself or herself. But as time goes on, without any benchmarking, in the larger context, it becomes difficult to justify the selective focus on certain details and not on others. If method is taken to mean a set of procedures that are designed to simplify the existing data according to a pre-existing analytical framework, then as Grossen put it in 2010, method is not compatible with dialogism. If method means inflexible procedure and method of analysis is not compatible with dialogism, if analysis means breaking down into component parts. However, the methods used in interpretive traditions of human social sciences have a different nature. There are a lot of ethnographic studies that achieve a thick description, for example. It is not achieved through the mechanical application of a procedure, but through the application of rich and context-specific cultural knowledge to pick out important clues and interpret the complex human significance of a particular utterance or action. In such a case, the scientist becomes, or the scientist or the teacher becomes the research instrument, and this cultural knowledge is needed to be able to understand the dialogues and the context, and the theoretical knowledge provides important lessons. Now, there are some questions that need to be used by which to operationalize theory by turning theory into prompts for interpretation. So, what are these questions? The first one is, what is the context? The context of an utterance or action or any teaching learning scenario refers to the whole situation within which it occurs, including both the setting framed by institutions, culture, history, educational context, etc., and the participants, their behaviors, goals, expectations, etc. The importance of context is such that the meaning of the participants in the scenario, sometimes even if it is not self-evident, depends on the context. Secondly, what is the speaker doing? The second sensitizing question that probes deeper into the activity context, it asks, what is it that the speaker is doing? It is widely agreed that utterances are actions and that people do things with words, as Austin in 1962 had surmised, or Wittgenstein in 1953 had surmised. Accordingly, many analysis of discourse begins with the question, what is this particular thing doing here? Or what is this participant doing here? How is it that we can address this? Why is this utterance, phase, or action happening now? To understand what is being done, there are three sub-questions. Number one, what prompted the utterance? Number two, what is the alternative that is being argued against? And number three, what is the speaker trying to set up? Point number three is an important one as to who is the addressee, who is being addressed in a teaching learning situation. As it is with others, Bakhtin had observed that all utterances are addressed to an audience, not simply in the sense of being spoken in the presence of an audience, but in the sense that it is tailor-made for the audience and anticipating the audience response. So you have to use the audience's composition or their interests or their level to understand how this thing will go through. The speaker monitors what he is saying in the audience, and the audience gives some feedback, and the audience feedback then modifies the way in which the speaker can modulate his or her topic. Speaker obviously does not know the position of the audience, but then it is assumed that it is the audience which will play a major role in sensitizing this. So there are several sub-questions that can be used for this. Number one sub-question for how to understand who is being addressed is, what does the utterance assume about its audience? Secondly, does the utterance or the teaching address any third party? With all these previous examples that you have seen, you can decide how the interpretation is going to be about data that is required beyond the utterance itself. So the context is an important part of the entire teaching learning process. The fourth point is, who is doing the talking? That means, who is the speaker? Obviously, it is the speaker, the person who is creating the lecture or the dialogue that is there, who is the talker. But the speaker is responding to something. That means he is engaging in some action. He is trying to have some effect on the audience. Yes, that is how you must think of yourself as a creation of knowledge, as a creator of knowledge. Now, the utterance appears that it is a distant and barely audible to a person who is at the far end. So you have to involve each and every individual within the boundary of the utterance. And therefore, each utterance or each part of knowledge, when you discuss the dialogue, will create its own history, will reflect its own history. The change of perspective from here will be that these ideas, phrases, words can be used, reused, recontextualized, and put to new and novel uses. But they are never completely dominating the original structure. As Bakhtin has put it, if words could be severed from their history, they would become meaningless. Each word tastes, quote unquote, of the context and contexts in which it has lived its socially charged life. That is what Bakhtin says in 1981. Now, this is not to say that utterances are determined by history. Rather, it is to say that there is a tension between the possibilities of discourse, and the dialogic framework can become one of the methods in which knowledge can be generated. Now, there could be several sub-questions to it. Does the utterance require any quotation, or does it contain any quotation? Secondly, how does the speaker respond to the quotation? Thirdly, is the utterance or quotation voicing a cultural mode, a cultural aspect? It is often helpful to understand and ask this narrative question. Fourthly, what is the genre of the interaction? An analyst can ask this question, an expert can ask this question, and therefore provide each participant with expectations and acceptable things to say in terms of sustaining the stability and micro-history and micro-culture of a pattern of learning. Fifthly, what future is constituted by the knowledge? Bakhtin says, quote unquote, "An utterance is never just a reflection or an expression of something already existing outside, and that is given and final. It always creates something that never existed before, sometimes something absolutely new and unrepeatable." Inverted commas close. While speakers try to do many things with their words, interpreting them takes the utterance to a next level. But first we have to ask another sub-question of how the future is constituted, or how the future is made. How does the utterance, in this case, that knowledge, make history, is an important part. Secondly, how does that knowledge or utterance position various people? And thirdly, what responses are enabled or constrained by the utterance? Because the present concern is not upon the intent of the speaker, but rather upon the actual consequences of the utterance, for the direction of the utterance. So what is the outcome that is irrespective of what the speaker's intention was? And finally, we have this question, what were the responses now to these utterances, to this piece of knowledge? Now again, we can look at some of the sub-questions when we consider the responses of each party, each one taking into the reconstruction of the meaning. So the first sub-question could be, what is the response of the person, of the person who is putting forward the position, the interlocutor? Secondly, what is the response of other people? The second sub-question is that, how do other people respond to it? Thirdly, what is the response of the speaker? And so these point out that how this dialogic process, we do not know what exactly would we come to, and what we are going to say, or what other person is going to say, and we can surprise ourselves, and we can surprise others by what we say or don't say. But at the same time, it also facilitates the creation of meaning and the stabilizing of the concept in the first place. Now, when we are asking these questions, we also need to understand that there are some clues that need to be followed, or cues that need to be followed about all these things. Now, the clues that come about the sensitizing questions, like what is the context? So we can utterance, if it is out of place, then there could be a contradiction, contraindications, or some things like what is the speaker doing, which prompts the utterance in the first place, or who is being addressed, there is a hesitation, and the audience, there is a resistance. So these are clues and cues by which there is this important clues for identifying these valuable lines of analysis. And therefore, the entire scheme of understanding any topic or anything with a broader contextual knowledge, that is through participation, observation, background interviews, documentation, discussion, and all sorts of enabling procedures and interpretations, can lead to a very, very important and significant way in which we can understand the context of education. In conclusion, we can say that dialogic conversations can contribute to the debate about the possibility of this being a very useful method for analyzing and understanding the role of context in our educational process, and more broadly to contribute to the debates about how and what methods are appropriate for any legitimate educational procedure. Thank you.